was the birth of Anaglouka's first child was on paper relatively uncomplicated. Anna felt as though she was pushed through a conveyor belt system of care in which she had limited agency or say. So when Anna is pregnant with her second child, she is determined to do things differently and take center stage of her own birth experience. She plans for a home birth and makes a conscious decision to trust her body. And it turns out Anna's body knows exactly what to do when she goes into labor cold October morning. This is a wonderful birth story of trusting one's instinct and is testament to that it is possible to have an empowering, amazing birth after a previous difficult experience. With us in the studio is Nairi Wright, midwife and founder of Sage Fam, to answer any questions. My name is Caroline Johansson. You're listening to the podcast To Become a Mother. Hi, both. Welcome, Anna. Welcome, Nairi.
Hi there.
Hi, how are you doing?
So it is Luna's birth that we will hear about today. And Luna is your youngest daughter and she's soon four. And yeah, I was going to ask you to start with when you started thinking now it's time to try for a second.
Yeah, so it wasn't so much that it was kind of like a decision now it's time to try for a second. I had my eldest Fionn in 2016 and we always knew that we wanted him to have a sibling. Siblings are a very important part of growing up, I think, for us anyway. And both myself and my partner have family members who are single children. Mm. And it's obvious in some aspects of how they interact with others that they've been brought up as a single child. So we always wanted Fionn to have a sibling for that kind of just to play and just kind of develop the ability to interact with other people quite quickly and peers quite quickly in his life. So I didn't go on contraception after Fionn was born, just thinking, well, when it happens, we'll take it from there. But I fell pregnant relatively quickly. And I know it sounds funny, but it was a bit of a surprise because I was still breastfeeding and myself and my partner weren't exactly having like sex every day. It was just kind of as and when, as you know, kind of with a small child, yeah. It's not forethought on your mind. So yeah, we fell pregnant in 2017 and after 9 weeks, unfortunately, that little one miscarried. At the time, I wasn't particularly upset because I was kind of coming to terms with the thought of having two babies under the age of two, and that was freaking me out somewhat. Yeah. So it was just something I felt, okay, it just wasn't meant to be, and it happened. I then fell pregnant with Luna in early 2018, and that actually was when having miscarried before, that's when that really impacted me because I was like, oh, throughout that pregnancy, I was always thinking, ah, she's not going to make it. She's not going to make it. She's not going to make it. And thankfully she did. But that's always kind of setting your expectations off the back of past experiences. So that was kind of always just bubbling in my mind. And you know, those kind of late nights when you're in bed and you're kind of, your thoughts come in on you. That was always in my mind. And even at kind of like 38, 39, 40 weeks, I was thinking, oh, she's going to be a stillbirth. She's not going to make it. Just these, it wasn't just overwhelming me, but it was just these little insidious kind of thoughts that come through. So as I said, it was always a decision that we wanted to have a second. And yeah, so Luna came about kind of the end of 2018, October 2018. So yeah.
And those thoughts, that anxiety, it wasn't so, did you manage to cope with those worrying feelings or?
Yeah, I did because I'm quite a rational person. So you rationalize, right? And you know that these thoughts are coming out of a past experience. So you do, in the cold light of day, you can rationalize with them. You cope with them. But it is those kind of nighttime kind of like, this could happen. When those kind of demons come in and you were sat in the dark, maybe I was a couple of times kind of sat with Fionn in the dark just thinking, is this going to work? So I did cope with it because come the morning, it was always fine. It's just breathe out. It's fine. But yeah, in those darker moments, it kind of came in on you somewhat.
And how were you feeling in your pregnancy otherwise?
It was a great pregnancy. I was working pretty much throughout it. I'm a massage therapist. So I'm always on my feet. I'm always moving. And it didn't impact me. I was working up until kind of eight, and she was, I don't know, I think she must have been the 38 weeks I was working too. It was like still kind of, yeah. And it was just, it was a really good pregnancy. I had no aches or pains, a bit of heartburn, which I hadn't experienced with Fionn, which is a little bit annoying, but just, that was it. It was a really good pregnancy.
Did you have any cravings?
I did. I'm almost ashamed to admit this. I really craved having a cigarette. I was just so bizarre because I used to smoke, but I hadn't had a cigarette since like 2008. And we're now in like 2018, so 10 years. And no one around me was smoking. It wasn't like my partner smoked. My parents smoked, but whatever. But yeah, I was just like, oh, I'd love a cigarette. I was just like, what is that?
But is there anything behind what you are craving? Because I feel like women just seem to crave so many different things when they're pregnant.
Well, in some cases, it might be something that the body is lacking, but clearly not if you're craving cigarettes. But for example, a fairly common unusual one is women wanting to eat soil. And sometimes that's associated with quite severe anemia. Or I've also heard of people wanting to eat chalk when they're a bit calcium deficient. But as to what could lead somebody to want a cigarette, I don't know, to be honest. I'm not sure. It's very interesting, isn't
it? Very interesting. And when did you start thinking about what kind of birth you wanted to have with Luna?
It was, I mean, at my booking with the midwife, she actually said, have you thought about home birth? And this was off the back of a conversation we'd have with the fact that with the birth of Fionn, like I went in at 8:30 in the morning and he was born by 1:30. So for a first birth, it was seen as quite a quick birth. So that kind of put a little kind of seed in my mind. And then I spoke with my partner, Keith, and he was like, let's do it. And it really kind of gained traction because I think of my experience with Fionn and my birth experience with Fionn. In that, I mean, it was an okay experience. However, the more I look back on it, I realized that I was naive, I think, in that I was almost like a passive figure in that birth rather than like an active participant in that birth. And that sounds mad because you're the person giving birth, right? Of course, you're the active participant. But what I mean by that is with Fionn, there was kind of a cascade of interventions in that at, I can't remember exactly, I think it was kind of about 33, 34 weeks, my iron was low and had been continuously low despite taking supplements. So I was sent to a consultant and the consultant was like, oh no, your iron's fine, just take this. But as part of that consultancy, she measured my bump. And I knew at the time that she hadn't measured it as my midwife had been measuring it. Mm-hmm. And for her calculations, go, oh, you're a little bit small, aren't you? And at that point, that could have been a step where I said, well, actually, can you measure again, please? Because that's not how my midwife measures it. The way you put the tape measure isn't exactly how my midwife puts it. But I didn't at that point. I thought, okay, yeah, fine. She goes, oh, okay, we'll recommend you for a scan. So I was like, yeah, fine. This was at about 35 weeks and went to the scan. And during the scan, Fionn's heart rate was really fast. And they kind of checked that I hadn't drunk coffee and not taking my heart rate. And it was consistently fast to the point where the consultant on that day was like, well, we're going to have to do a cesarean. And I was like, no, I don't think so. And at that point, I was active as in like, well, let's wait. Let's see. Like, what is the worst that can happen in this situation? So he said, okay, let's keep you in overnight and see what happens in Fionn's birth. So Fionn's heart rate, fine, it went back to as it should be, and that was all fine. However, now, which I didn't realize at the time, I had now kind of almost like a red flag on my file, and this had happened. I didn't realize this would affect my birth plan at all. So when the time came to go into hospital, again, in the throes of labor, you're not kind of thinking about engaging with your caregivers in that way, as in like, where are you taking me and stuff. I was kind of ushered onto, not into the birth center, but into obstetric, like labor ward, essentially. And straight away, they put on the CTG?
That's what it's called.
For monitoring Fionn's heart rate and the contractions as well. So I had two monitors on me. And if you're not kind of aware what these look like, I had the very old-fashioned ones, where it's like elasticated belt, and it's this big kind of round, kind of the size of a maybe a small saucer, a kind of a couple of centimeters thick, kind of sitting on your belly. So I'm laboring with these two devices on, and I'm just, I want to get up, I want to move. So I went to get up and move, and a midwife came in and said, oh, no, so you can't move. You can't get up. You can't walk around. I'm just thinking, what the... what?
Mm.
But again, I didn't question it to that level. I just thought, okay, I'll lie back on the bed then, being kind of like, inverted commas, the good girl. And labouring continued, and it was getting very painful, and I had gas and air, which is fine. I was happy to have gas and air. And he was progressing. He was coming down the birth canal, but he wasn't kind of... he wasn't progressing as much as they would have liked. So I was at his actual birth. I was on my back, stirrups, episiotomy, ventouse, essentially. So ventouse to kind of on his skull to suck him out. I remember at one point when the doctor came in to do the episiotomy, and I think perhaps to put the ventouse on, I was making, because I was really tired at this point, and it was helping me to make noise, to push. That was what was helping me. And she said something along the lines of, stop making that noise. Put your efforts into pushing this baby out. And I'm thinking, what? At that point, I was quite angry, but I knew he was coming and I had to just focus in on that. Mm. And then so subsequently, I'm thinking all these other people that acted around me and made decisions around me, I didn't feel like how I made any of those decisions, really. And I think we all assume, and I think we rightly assume, obviously, our health providers, they do want the best for us, but they are working to a different criteria. They have to work within guidelines. They have, once you're kind of, that red flag is put on your file, you're on a certain pathway. And it's not person-centered care. As much as they want to say it is, it's not in the heat of it. You're kind of like, this is the pathway you're on. And unless you are the advocate for yourself, or you have someone to advocate on your behalf, you're just carried away on this river of guidelines, essentially. Yeah. So that made me angry, because that's, I'm not a passive person. And
Yeah, no, I was just thinking in terms of just the monitoring when you came in and you weren't able to move. Now, if that happens to you and you come in and they say, we need to monitor the baby, is there anything you can do if you want to have a labor where you walk around and you're active? Or is it just a case of you have to lie down and
rest? Well, sadly, although Anna referred to the fact that perhaps monitoring has changed, it's still exactly the same. It's still the two big elastic bands and the big circular dish on the top of the uterus to monitor. It's like a pressure pad that picks up when somebody's having a contraction, and then it's another big round disc to pick up the heartbeat. The only thing that has improved, it's becoming more common to have the availability of wireless monitoring. So instead of having the two long wires attached to the machine, it's picked up, I think it's by Bluetooth, and most hospitals have that option now. You still have the elastic straps, but in theory, you should be able to get up and mobilize. It's a difficult one, because if you need to be monitored for a specific reason, it needs to be good quality monitoring, otherwise you may as well not have it at all. So in some situations, it just gets really difficult to have a continuous trace. There's lots of episodes of loss of contact. And that's actually bad, because the only assumption they can make safely is, oh, this baby is really distressed, when actually it could just be that there's loss of contact. So sometimes it's that inability to get a good quality trace that makes them say, you have to sit still on your back. And, you know, I absolutely agree with Anna. It's so uncomfortable to sit still in one place. Instinctively in labor, you feel like you want to move. But if there is a good argument for monitoring a baby, it does need to be a good quality trace. Otherwise, you may as well not bother at all. They're basically trying to see the correlation between the contractions and the baby's heartbeat. So it's really about, how well is this little baby coping with the big squeeze that comes every time there's a contraction? Because for the duration of the contraction, the baby's having slightly less oxygen. And well-grown, healthy babies adapt to that very well. But if there is an issue such as bleeding, high blood pressure, I mean, there's lots of different indications, then potentially a baby isn't going to cope so well with that. And that's the whole purpose of monitoring.
Mm. I think in my case, it was the fact that it wasn't presented as a choice.
Oh, so it,
into yes. the room, put these on, there you go. And there was no explanation about this is why we are doing this. Mm. What do you think about this? This is the information for you to make that decision. Mm. And that's what I mean about kind of being a passive against an active participant in your labor, because if you're given that information that you and asked for your decision, you automatically become that active participant. And I think what really did it for me was that I was just passive and I didn't feel like I had a role in the birth of my own child, which obviously you should be the very center of that of that birth. So I think that's what it was for me in that situation, certainly.
And so when you had a chance to do it again, I guess you had a vision of doing it differently, of being more active the second time around in your own birth. And how did you go about preparing for it? Because the hospital, they don't really engage properly with you until you are 36 weeks.
In my case, it was about 36 weeks. And I think from what I've heard from other people, it's kind of they don't really talk about your birth plan and your birthplace choice until you're quite far along in your pregnancy, just in case things want to change. It's almost like they don't want to build expectations up. In your mind, I think it's almost like they're trying to don't kind of do damage limitation in a way, kind of, because they don't want to think, oh yeah, you can have a home birth, of course you can, and then something comes up where guidelines say, well, maybe you shouldn't have a home birth. So that's what it feels like to me. So kind of in terms of my own preparation, it was an interesting one. It was a balancing act, because I was very conscious that I didn't want to get too analytical about the birth and to really trust my body and what it's doing. So I didn't want my active brain, my thinking brain almost, to kind of kick in during the birth. I really just wanted to feel what was going on in my body and listen to that more, because I live my life too much in my head anyway. So I didn't want to, I didn't want that encroach on my birth. And I didn't want to start thinking about my experience with Fiona or anything like that. I just really wanted to be in that moment. So I didn't do too much preparation. I did know that I didn't want a water birth. I think when a lot of people hear home birth, they automatically think of a birth pool.
Yeah.
That wasn't for me. I was just thinking about the faff.
So you start
labor.
And it's
like,
too.
So it's just like, you have to blow it up, and then you have to fill it. Someone has to do that for you because you're laboring, and then it has to be tidied away. And I know that most midwives will help with the tidying away and stuff, but what? Yeah. And it's not a natural thing to have in your house as well. One of the reasons why I wanted a home birth was to be in my environment, and having a blinking great kind of birth pool in the middle of my living room wasn't kind of like my natural environment. So yeah, I knew I wanted a land birth, and that was pretty much it.
And how do they set it up for a land birth then? Because like you, I've only really heard about home birth in a pool. Like, what do you get any specific, I don't know, plastic or something to put on the floor?
I usually give clients some waterproof covering for maybe the floor. I usually tell people to roll up their good rugs and put them away. Mm. Maybe get some pillows that they're prepared to throw away, so not the big expensive goose down ones. And then we usually bring... they're just large incontinence pads. I'm trying to think of a nice way of saying it, but no, that's what they are. And those are brilliant because you can literally use them for the floor, for the bed, when somebody steps out of the shower. There's all sorts of good uses for those, and they get thrown away. And I think that you can't really necessarily prepare a designated area, because an awful lot of women won't decide where they're going to give birth until the moment. And it's interesting what Anna said about wanting to be instinctive and to shut off her thinking brain. We often labour best when we can do that. And one of the things that women do if they're completely left to their own devices is they seek out a cosy, small space often where it's dark. And I guess it's a fairly primitive response, similar to, you know, a dog that goes under a cupboard to have puppies. It's similar for women, I think. Mm. And so therefore, you might have to keep moving the equipment around the house as they decide where they want to give birth.
So having a mobile setup is...
Yeah, because in my head, I was like, I'm going to give birth in the bedroom. Just felt that's the place to give birth. But as it turned out, I didn't give birth in the bedroom at all. No.
When did you start feeling that labour might be underway?
So at this point I was 41 plus one, and I really wanted labor to start soon because they were already talking about induction and sweeps and stuff like that. And you're unable to have a home birth if you go beyond 42 weeks. So I was getting a bit fearful about that, actually.
Why is that, Nairi, that you are not allowed to have a home birth after a certain time?
I think, first of all, it's not that it's not allowed, but it isn't recommended. Mm-hmm. And the reason is that stillbirth is a low risk. It really is. But then when you plot it on a graph, the risk goes up quite steeply on the curve after 42 weeks. And the reasons for that are that by 42 weeks, quite a few placentas may not be working so well. It's obviously very individual, but the NHS, understandably, can't focus in on every individual pregnancy. So they have to look at the data, and the data has sort of decided that 42 weeks, the risks of stillbirth go up, partly because of the placenta. In addition to that, what happens by 42 weeks is that the baby's skull bones become slightly less better at being able to mold. So the baby's skull is harder, if you like. The baby is bigger. And the final reason is that because producing the amniotic fluid is a function of a healthy placenta, by 42 weeks, there may be less amniotic fluid. And on top of that, by 42 weeks, quite a few babies will think about doing a poo before they're born. And so therefore, you may have the meconium in a smaller amount of amniotic fluid. And so potentially during the birth process, the baby could swallow some of it. So if you put all of those things together, it's generally not recommended, but it shouldn't ever be presented in a way you're not allowed to have a home birth. Because if women are really fearful about induction, a better approach is, let's have a look at how your baby's doing. Let's have a look at how your placenta is doing. And, you know, maybe suggest a scan, have some extra monitoring, and make an alternative plan that somebody is comfortable with. And I do appreciate that's difficult to do in the NHS, but I do think that women need to feel like they're not a passive person in a birth, as Anna described. Yes. That you need to be a more active participant in decision making.
Yeah, absolutely. And just knowing that there is an option to actually check some other things instead of just taking the induction, I think it's just very empowering.
Yeah, exactly. I think it is about how information is presented to you as well, and making sure that the range of information is presented to you and not just what the NHS wants you to see, whoever's supporting you wants to see. I mean, it's interesting, you should say kind of after 42 weeks, stillbirth rates do increase, and they do increase, but they increase from 1 in 1,000 to 2 in 1,000. But you could kind of present that as 1 in 1,000 to 2 in 1,000, or you could say they double. And it is a very different way of presenting information. But they were starting to talk about that because I was 41 plus one. So I was kind of like, okay, you need to come now, you know. you need to get a move on, because I don't fancy a battle with my midwives about my birthplace choice. So I kind of woke up at about 1:30 that morning, and I was like, ah, is this something starting? Not quite sure. Went to the, I thought it was like a stomach kind of pain, not pains, but just discomfort. Went to the toilet, and that seemed to sort things out and calm things down. So I think, well, maybe it's just something I ate, or obviously in pregnancies, things can kind of affect you. And I was like, okay, so I read my book for a little bit, and it kind of settled down. So I just went back to bed and had a really sound sleep, kind of woke up again at about 7 when Fionn came down. And at that point, I was thinking, oh no, this is something starting. But again, I was going on my experience with Fionn. When things started with Fionn, between things kind of starting and him being born was a good kind of 12 hours. So I was just like, it's fine. It's fine. Okay, yep. Keith, you go to work. It just happened to be the day that my mum had Fionn. I was like, yeah, mama, fine. Just take Fionn. It's all good. It's all fine. Once the house was kind of empty, our bit of the house was empty, I was like, yeah, I'm just going to do some hoovering. just going to do a bit of cleaning, going to clean the kitchen, do a bit of hoovering. Obviously going into full nesting mode. I was just like, yes, let's just get things clean. Let's just get things sorted.
I find that so fascinating that women, when they're approaching or about to give birth, they just decide that now it's time to clean massively and, yeah, tidy everything. Yeah. Is there a reason for that, Mary? That, or is it just... Let's prepare for the baby.
I think it's just a hormonal instinct because it isn't always logical. Mm. When I was expecting my second son, we had builders in and there was brick dust everywhere, but I was still on my hands and knees scrubbing the skirting board, even though they were, you know, due to come back the next day. So I don't think it's always logical. It's overwhelming. And I think that partners also have it, but they just do it a bit differently. So it might be, I need to get another contract, or I need to get a new car. You know, that's perhaps how they do it. I don't know.
Yeah.
I think it really helped. Those 2 hours of cleaning really helped me because I wasn't focused in so much on what was going on kind of with my body. It's like I'll do a bit of hoovering. Oh, yeah, I'll just lean against this wall as a contraction happened and then carry on. It's like I was task-driven for those couple of hours and rather than sitting contemplating what was going to happen next. So, yeah, I kind of was cleaning till about 11:30. I was a bit hungry now. Go make some toast, have a cup of tea. Delicious. And then as soon as I'd taken kind of like the cup and the plate to the kitchen, I kind of came back into the living room. That's when I was like, whoa, this just really kicked on. It was just like that. It just happened. So waters broke. So this was about kind of 11:30, 12 o'clock, and the things just absolutely ramped up. I text Keith, my partner. I was like, you need to come home from work now. He was very much, subsequently I found out he was still very much in kind of thinking about kind of like how long Fionn took to come. And he was just like, oh, okay, should I come home? I was like, yes, you need to come home now. I phoned the home birth midwives. So they're NHS midwives attached to a hospital, but they're a dedicated team. They're absolutely amazing. And said, okay, yeah, I think things are starting here. And subsequently, again, I've spoken to the midwife who actually delivered Luna. And she said she heard my call come in and she heard my voice because I was on speakerphone in the office. And she was like, I need to get to that woman, because it was just like, apparently midwives can tell. I don't know if that's the case. Midwives can tell by voice. Is that true?
What is it in the voice that's telling?
Sometimes you can hear the sort of animal type noises that women make when they want to bear down. But otherwise, what you can usually tell is you'll have a little chat with them and then a surge will come and they have to pause or they have to start breathing a little bit more deeply. And obviously, we also then take into account which baby number is it, because, you know, Anna's right, most first labours are long, but some second labours in particular are very quick. So we always have that in our mind.
Okay.
I think the thing that Saskia said as well is they asked me to get my notes because they needed my NHS number or something. And my notes were in the bedroom because that's where I was going to give birth. And I was just like, I can't. I just can't. It was like, it was like a couple of seconds from the living room to the bedroom because it's on the same floor. And I was just like, I can't physically go and get those notes. And that's when I think she's like, okay, we need to come and support you in this. So I did manage to wind back a little bit. I did manage to get my kind of birthing Pilates ball from the bedroom. I don't know why I wanted the living room. Maybe it's because I just hoovered it and I was like, this is definitely the place I want to give birth. I've just cleaned. So I brought it into the living room and kind of propped it up against the sofa. And then I was kind of like on my knees with my upper body on the birthing ball and just kind of swaying with the contractions and letting them kind of, as much as I can, kind of just kind of pass through
me. Was that very instinctual? That's what you felt you wanted to do?
Yeah, and the noises that were kind of coming were very kind of primeval kind of noises that kind of were emanating from me. And I was just like, yeah, I'm just going to go with this. But all the time I was kind of like, I had my phone on the sofa seat. And I was just keeping an eye on the time because I knew what time I'd told Keith and the midwife they need to come. And I just wanted to see what kind of how long it was taking. At that point, my brother and sister-in-law were living at the top of the house. And I heard my sister-in-law coming down to leave the house to go to work. And I was just like, do I call her? Should I call her? Do I need her here? Mm. And I can remember very distinctly kind of running through the kind of like, what would she bring to the situation? At that point, she'd not had children herself. Mm. Would she be a benefit? Would she be a distraction to me? I very quickly made this decision. I was like, no, I'm not going to call her down. Mm. She is on her way to work. I don't, it'd be some excuse not to turn up to work, but I don't want to upset her working day as well. And said, no, I want to be alone. I want to be alone in this moment. And I do remember very distinctly thinking that, but then also was thinking, I need Keith and the midwife to be here. They need to be here now. Because even though I didn't know it at the time, I was very close to actually giving birth. Yeah. So Keith came back at about just before one, just breezed in. Again, having spoken to him subsequently, he was very much in the mindset, this is going to take a long time. It's fine. He's like, I'm really hungry. I'm just going to make a sandwich, like breezed into the kitchen. I'm thinking, oh, okay, yeah, fine. Make that sandwich. Well, I remember kind of looking, because you can see the kitchen from the living room. I just kind of remember looking down towards the kitchen, and he's just making this ham sandwich for himself. And I'm just like, I'm about to have a baby and he's making a sandwich. It's fine. And then Saskia, my midwife, I didn't know Saskia before. She was just part of the home birth team, but I'd not met her before. She arrived and Keith let her in. It was almost like I've thought about this a lot. I can remember exactly what she's wearing. As a home birth midwife, they wear their own clothes, essentially. Mm. And I remember she had like these like wonderful skirts she had on and leg warmers. And she just looked so kind of like Mother Earthy. And she had beautiful, like curly, like blonde hair. And it was almost like imprinted on me. And I've often thought about, you know, how they say kind of like baby birds, they get the imprint of whoever they hatch and see that's imprinted, that's their mother. And I think, well, I'm birthing to become a mother again. So this is like imprinted on me, like what Saskia looked like when she came in. And she was amazing. So she just came in and she was very just like calm, gentle, serene. So like, would you mind if I'd had a quick look, had checked? And she's so kind of just, she wasn't obtrusive in any way. She just came in and just kind of looked, and she just kind of saw kind of how progression was. It was lovely. It was like she just brought this calm energy with her as well. I mean, it was pretty calm in there anyway, but she just really brought this, just like just settled it all down. And I thought actually, she came down and she said, oh, I can see the head. And I thought at that moment, she's just being encouraging. She's just encouraging me along. She could see the head. And I was like, this is kind of a few minutes past 1 o'clock. But again, she just sat back and she just let me do my thing. And it was beautiful. She wasn't interfering in any way. She put, the constant pads that you're talking about. So I had some, the big like puppy training pads. Just put one of those just discreetly under my knees and was just sat there, and I could just see her behind me when I kind of looked kind of underneath my arm, as it were, because I'm on all fours. She's just sitting there, just observing, just taking like little notes, and just almost, she wasn't in my space at all. Even though she was like less than a meter away from me, she had this presence where she wasn't in my space. She wasn't kind of like, she wasn't kind of like hovering. She was just there if I needed her. And that was absolutely amazing to experience that, and such a stark contrast to my first birth, where I had all these people in and out of the room and observing me and taking measurements and asking me questions. She just sat. And then my body at that point, I was really, it was just these massive surges, just like these just huge waves kind of coming through me. And this just, it's a difficult pain to describe childbirth pain, as you both know. There aren't quite the words to describe, because it's not a pain that I think you ever experience in any other situation. It's like this immense pressure, and you need to alleviate this pressure, and that's what you're doing. It's, to call it pain is almost like it, that doesn't fit with it. It is painful, but it's kind of, it's just different. You can't really describe it. But I was experiencing that, and it's like I just, this need to get Luna out of my body. And kind of had one big push and the head kind of fully came out. And I was like, right, yeah, that's it. Just get the next push in. And I actually started pushing against contraction. And Saskia goes, no, just wait. It's fine. You don't need to rush. It's all good. And yeah, another quick push. And Luna, as Keith said, just came shooting out. And Saskia literally caught her and then quickly passed her kind of under me. Into me. It was a bit awkward, actually, because the umbilical cord was kind of like a bit wrapped up in me and her. And it was kind of like, but yeah, that's kind of, it was very quick from Saskia and Keith arriving. It was half an hour. She was born at 1:30, essentially.
So Keith barely had time to eat his ham sandwich.
I don't know if he did eat his ham sandwich. I'm not sure if he did. But yeah.
Yeah, it's very beautiful how you describe it. And also what you said before about the first birth and they all being so involved in it. And here you have Saskia just sitting, being completely passive in your birth, which, yeah, it's
exactly was beautiful. What you need. Yeah, she was, I just knew she was there. So she was there enough that I knew I was supported, but she wasn't there enough that she was just encroaching on my space and making me feel anywhere uncomfortable, like I needed to do something. She was just, Yeah, it was lovely.
And you said you hadn't met her before. Is that now when NHS, when you have a home birth team, do you normally meet them before, or is it just who's available?
I think it depends on area. So some areas are perhaps better staffed than others. But I think in London, it's fairly common now that there might be a team of, say, 6 to 8 midwives, and they may do a clinic on rotation. So you could, by luck, meet the midwife who ends up having your baby, sorry, helping you give birth. But very often it isn't. It might be somebody that you haven't met before.
Okay. Yeah. And so how is that immediate time after?
It was wonderful because I was at home. So I was just instantly at ease and comfortable. I would say the slight kind of fly in the ointment was that NHS guidelines say that a second midwife should be attending in a home birth. But everything's so quick, so I didn't have the second midwife during the birth, but a second midwife did come because the home birth team didn't have anyone available. That midwife was called from the local hospital, and she kind of like breezed in the exact opposite of Saskia. The exact opposite. She kind of breezed in, like the first thing she was kind of like on about was how hungry she was. This was her lunch break. No, she didn't understand why she was there because the birth had already happened. At one point, she even said, "Oh, I didn't know we still did home births." And she was just the exact opposite of this beautiful, calm presence that Saskia was. And you could see Saskia was a little bit by it, but was being very professional about it all. But she was the polar opposite. And it was just, at that point, I had Luna in my arms and it was fine. And it was, I could have asked her to leave. I was like, oh, I don't want to like put Saskia in a position where she's compromised in any way. That was a little bit of a fly in the ointment in those first few hours. But apart from that, it was beautiful. Kind of like, I felt really empowered and strong. And in the immediate kind of like, few hours afterwards, I was like, yeah, let's do it again. I want to do that again. It was because the adrenaline and the endorphins and everything had just hit that sweet spot. I'd just eaten before. I'd slept the night before. Everything was perfectly conducive to having this amazing birth experience. It was so kind of different from my first birth experience. It was so my birth. I had made these decisions. I had birthed this child. If you think with the birth of Fionn, he was born by Ventouse. So someone else's pulling him, even though I'm pushing, I still had this kind of like, okay, someone else was part of that, but someone else was pulling him out. Whereas with Luna, it was like, it was all me. It was like, it was kind of really kind of a testament to the power of the female body and what you can do and what have you. I was just so invigorated and enlivened by the whole thing. I was on such a buzz after Luna was born. It was amazing.
Yeah, I can understand. It sounds incredible. And Fionn, when does he come home? And had you made any, you know, when you have a second child, there are all these considerations that you don't have when you give birth the first time about how is it going to be between my two children? How are we going to introduce them? Had you considered that carefully?
We had considered that. And as I said, it just so happened the day Luna was born, that was the day that my mum usually took Fionn to hers just to look after him for a bit and to bond with him and catch up with him. However, if it hadn't been on a Thursday, he would have been in the house with me, or he might have been at nursery, actually. But we did consider that, and like, what would we do with Fionn? Would we be happy to be part of that birth experience? And kind of the answer was yes, because it's a family experience. He came to the sonographer appointment with me at 24 weeks, and we actually got the sonographer to tell Fionn first the sex of the baby so he could tell us, because we really wanted him to be involved in the whole process, because as you said, sibling dynamics, and you just don't know how it's going to be when you've got a new baby on the scene and you've got a toddler. You don't know how that's going to be. And so we really did want him to be involved. Two tips actually that I was given before giving birth, I'm really glad that we took on board, was that the new baby should always have a gift for the older sibling. Yeah. So Luna like bought him a toy digger, which is amazing. How did she know? So there was a toy digger waiting for Fionn in Luna's Moses basket. And the second tip was, when we heard my mum pull up in the car, my dad, we had Luna in the Moses basket for Fionn to discover. So Luna wasn't in either of our arms when he came through the door. She was there to be discovered by Fionn. He did discover her and then quickly discovered the digger, and that took priority over this new member of the family. But yeah, it was definitely a consideration. I think most parents think about the dynamic of when a new member of the family is introduced, for how the older child is going to feel. Yeah. So yeah, that was definitely on our mind.
And how did it then continue being a mom to a little new baby and then having a toddler, I can imagine it's quite intense.
It is intense. I can only kind of like, when people have asked me about this, like people that have only got one child or no children, it's like, remember when you've had one child and you think, wow, I had so much time when I didn't have any children. What did I do with that time? The same thing when you have two children, like, wow, I had so much time when I only had one child. I was just, what was I doing with that time? You're just on like an autopilot. You're just doing it. You need to meet the needs of your toddler and your newborn. And you're living in this kind of like linear kind of like, just go, just keep moving, just keep moving forward. Don't stop. Just keep moving. Just keep moving. But Fionn like took to Luna really well. There wasn't any kind of behavior changes in him that we perceived. He was never kind of vocalized or showed that he wasn't happy with this new arrival. There were lots of cuddles that turned into aggressive love, is what I'd call it. So it's a little bit too tight, which is quite common. Subsequently, I've spoken to other mothers and said, yeah, they're aggressive love. So you kind of have to kind of try and mediate that. You don't want them not to be hugging or interacting with the new arrival, but at the same time you don't want them squeezing them so hard that they kind of like can't breathe. So it's about kind of that negotiation about how you approach kind of telling the older child, it's really good that you are kind of giving her cuddles, but a little bit less. But yeah, you just get on with it. There's no other word for it. You just get, and thankfully my breastfeeding journey with Luna was amazing. Like, she came onto the breast pretty much straight after giving birth, and she was born to do it. She just latched and she just did it, and she was just gulping straight away. She was ravenous, and she's still breastfeeding. Actually, she has occasional feed. She loves the breast, so that was easy. By the time Luna rolled around, I realized that co-sleeping is fine. That was a big part of my immediate journey with Fionn, was that I was terrified of co-sleeping, so I didn't co-sleep at all with Fionn. So when he was hungry in the night, I'd get up, sit in the chair, feed, go back to bed, put him in the crib, go back to bed. And in hindsight, that was so detrimental to my mental health. It was really kind of, that sleep deprivation was really impactful on how I was functioning. But time Luna rolled around, I was like, no, it's at home. But I think also because she was at home, that just felt so much more natural to have her safely in bed with us. And so when she wanted to feed, she'd just have a little feed and I could be dozing. So everything was fine after Luna's birth because she was quite an easy baby and Fionn really loves and loved his new sister. So it was quite a relatively smooth time, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, nice. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Your story.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.